Just looking ahead to the fall, I checked the calendar and used the dates I came up with. If you want to jot them down for yourself, we'll start on September 7th and then go every other week, but I noted down the dates. So it would be September 7 and 21, October 5 and 19, November 2 and 16, December 3 and 14. 14. No, that can't be right. Must be 3 and 17. Yeah, I must have been thinking 14 days from the 3rd.
So we know what we're going to be meeting yet?
No.
Okay.
December 17th is a Sunday.
What did
Thursday
I do?
Before us.
Is December 3rd a Thursday?
No, it's a Sunday too.
Oh my God. Is November 16th a Thursday?
No, it's a Saturday. Uh-oh. Let me just go back to what you had. 11-16 and then it would be...
Let's start at the beginning. September 7th? Is that a Thursday?
September 7th is a Thursday, but it, yes. And it's Friends of Young and yes, it's on there.
The 21st?
Yes.
Then October 5th?
Yes.
October 19th?
Yes.
November 2nd?
Yes.
November 16th?
Yes. Then there's a 30th. I don't know if you want to do every other one or you want to...
Yes, I do want to do every one.
That's the 30th.
Oh, God.
One Thanksgiving, the 23rd, the week before.
So November 30th, thank you.
2, 16, 30.
And then...
would be the 14th and 28th.
We'll just do the 14th then. Yeah, just do the 14th.
14th.
So the 14th will be the last.
And then do you know when we'll start back?
Probably a month. We won't meet the 28th.
Right.
So it'll be like 4 weeks from the...
Mid-January?
It won't be 2 weeks from the 28th.
2 weeks.
Like the 12th or something like that.
And we go to the next Thursday?
We always skip 2 weeks.
Okay, then it's the 4th of January
until
it
was
January 4th.
No.
No, we won't start that 28th. You want 2 weeks from the
28th. 2 weeks from the 28th.
It'll be the 11th.
January 11th.
January 11th. That kind of helps plan the first year.
Yeah, and then you can pretty much figure every other week except for, I don't know, if it falls on Easter. Actually, we meet like each week of Easter. The only time we don't meet is Thanksgiving.
So we're
going
2 weeks.
We always go either 2 or 4 weeks. I think because of room issues. And I guess I'll email you. I've got your emails, I think. I'll let you know where. I hope it's that extra conference room at the church, but I'll have to call Karin to find out. You know, that other building, second floor, there's a couple of conference rooms, which actually are nicer. I don't know if they're nicer, but they're a little bit more meal-free, for one thing. And the table's bigger. More people can sit at the table.
You mean the same location?
The same location, but across the street. Mm-hmm. Second floor.
I'm going to feel quite as guilty about trashing the God image.
I don't, for some reason. Thank you for pointing that out. So, quick review. Welcome back, everyone, and thanks to for Nancy's hospitality. We'll go till about we'll go for about an hour, so about 1:15, and then I have just a short DVD clip, not really about Pauli, but about the times. It's the introduction to the play Copenhagen. They talk about Heisenberg and Bohr and so on. Remember that story of Copenhagen that the.
IRT?
It's at the IRT, and this is a PBS version of it. And I was surprised it was so wildly popular. I saw it 3 times at the IRT, and every night it was packed.
Oh,
at the upper stage. I think it was like on Thursday night sometimes I'd go just to see it. So I think it says something about this stuff being ready for cultural consciousness. And Pauli, Heisenberg, and Bohr were the three main players in the development of quantum physics in Copenhagen in 1927. And if you just think ahead, when the war came, Pauli got out of Switzerland. He was in the United States. Bohr was in Copenhagen still. Heisenberg, a German, was back in Germany, and Heisenberg was the head of the Nazi bomb project. So here were these guys who were all friends, who were absolutely at odds in the war, and Bohr was then, Denmark was occupied. And Bohr was half Jewish, I think, too, so he was really in danger. And historically then, as Heisenberg came to Copenhagen to talk to Bohr during the war, nobody knows what they talked about, but they were, of course, all very good friends, and after that, they never spoke to each other. So it's thought that Heisenberg approached Bohr to work on the Nazi bomb project. That's what they think. And that's Bohr just apparently, I mean, he was like the European humanist to the core. And the play then is a historical fictionized account of what may have happened. And what this video is just introducing the average person to who Bohr was, who Heisenberg was. That kind of fits into what we're doing. I thought it would be fun. A quick review. We spent quite a bit of time last week talking about typology and the fact that in the 16th dream there were four keys, meaning that he had to begin to look at things from all functions. As we'll see, his horrible spot was his feeling, and the problems that caused him really start to become clear as he gets to know von Franz. It's almost difficult for me to read this now without cringing, some of the things he says. You'll see just how insensitive he was on a feeling level. Just on page 57, we talked a little bit about Pauli's own view of the stranger, which is a figure we're going to be seeing pretty much consistently from now to the end, although at the very end he changes the stranger's name to the master. And the stranger would represent the unity of matter and spirit, I think, to put it in the simplest way. And the stranger is always egging him on, always challenging him, always acting in a way that seems contrary to science. But what Pauli feels is what he's really trying to do, what the stranger is trying to do, is actually add another dimension to science. And the only reason he seems to be against it is that Pauli is identified with the status quo in science. So the stranger is about transforming our view of really of matter, but then to the extent that the way we see ourselves is a reflection of the way we see the material world, it's also about changing our view of life, not just of science. Page 62, we mentioned in the guide that Pauli and von Franz began a friendship in 1951. Soon as that happens, we have two whoppers, which is where we left off. In the first dream, Pauli is driving up a hill. This is on page 62. And the skin on his left leg begins to peel away. The road ends and he has to continue by foot. There is some issue about him getting the wrong hat, and he realizes then that it's only possible to go further by the light of the moon. That's the big red flag, the light of the moon. And he considers it dangerous and the end point doubtful, and he stops. In the second dream of that night, on 63, he's in the Gasthof, which is like the restaurant pub called the Old Sun. And the dignitaries of the community are sitting, and a young blonde is crying, saying that she's going to lose her Swiss citizenship because she's marrying a German. And then at the end, one of the dignitaries says that Fräulein von Franz is also going to marry here, and then he wakes up. And all of this, the second dream, began with the stranger going to meet him at this old sun restaurant. So they're very, very important dreams, because we're going to see how his creative task and his relationship opportunity go hand in hand. And he's going to, if he funks one, he's going to funk the other. Of course, he does funk Bonfance, and he also funks his task, and then he dies. The skin peeling from the left leg would probably mythologically be a reference to the snake shedding its skin. And that is one of the prime images used by the psyche to represent major transformation. The snake being at the absolute deepest level, level of the spinal column, you could say, is transforming, which means that he should transform at depth. The hat business, we're going to see coming back several times, has to do with his persona identification. He was such a big shot in the world of physics, and just in Zurich, he was like a prima donna of Zurich, the Nobel Prize winner, you know, etc. Really, the usher of a whole new physics and so on. He is constantly struggling to give that up and deal with the loss of popularity that comes when you speak the truth. And the light of the moon would be the light of Eros. What's that mean practically? That means that here I think that the light of the moon would be for him to listen to the meaning of his feelings for von Franz. See, they didn't make rational sense to him. They don't make rational sense very often. If they do, you're lucky. And the logical thing would be to critique the feelings on the basis of what's practical, what's sensible. But the feelings do not care about what's practical and what's sensible, and they are what's coming from the self.
You say he should critique them?
Well, in a way, yes. He critiqued them and dismissed them.
Oh, okay.
From the point of view of rationality. This doesn't make sense. I'm married, you know, blah, blah, blah. It'd be humiliating. People found out. We'll see us together. You know, we'll be talked about, blah, blah, blah. And so on that basis, he slowly distances himself from her after a period of fascination. And, you know, by contrast, if you think what Jung went through, I may have said this, there's that video of an interview with Jung's daughter where she said that when they moved to Kuznak, which would be like the, I don't know, kind of the Carmel or the Noblesville of Zurich, the mothers of the neighborhood had a meeting whether they should allow his children to play with her children. I mean, imagine how that felt. But Jung risked that. You know, he said, too bad, I am not silencing my voice because I am being socially ostracized. But Pauli couldn't do that. He had to be seen as the cool guy. So, it's... And this is the way the psyche works. I think all of us are basically identified with our reason. We couldn't exist in the world if we weren't. You have to think about how you're going to spend your money, how you're going to deal with your neighbors, all these things. And then these experiences come along where the feelings emerge and they don't make sense. But that is the way the self works. It comes at us in the mode that... can't be controlled by our thoughts and by our rationality. And so to follow the light of the moon will be to accept those feelings, live them out in some acceptable way, finally, I think, and then to let that feeling guide him where his work should go. And that's what he's afraid of. That's, to me, what it means to serve the feminine. So it's a bad omen. And see, that dream came right on the heels of their beginning that friendship. The next dream, again, uses really classic symbolism. The old sun is... there are two main images in alchemy, the sun and the king, and the moon and the queen. And, you know, if you read fairy tales, you see that most of them start out with a king. And most alchemical recipes start out with a king. There was a king who was ill and has to be resuscitated. Well, so the alchemists literally thought there was a sick king inside that material because they were living in a pre-scientific mindset. But the way Jung interprets that is that's a projection of our most central value. The king would be a projection of the value that we really live by. The value system that we really live by. And the sun would just be another image for that. You know, it's the light that illuminates everything. Where a candle, let's say, is a light maybe that illuminates a small area, the sun illuminates the whole world. So the sun and the king would be the predominant paradigm that we're living by. Well, Pali was all about, was supposed to be all about the transformation in paradigm, right? From Newton to quantum physics, and then the parallel of that in psychology from the split between spirit and matter to the unity of spirit and matter. So if this is taking place in the old sun, that means it's taking place in the old value system, and that is a very bad sign. Because what he should do is be about watching the sun set and then rise again. So it's the same image where he was afraid of the moon in the previous dream. Here he's identified with the sun, but the old sun. Which means finally he's going to come down on the side of the old value system, which really, in science, he helped transform, but now he's supposed to deal with that in his personal life and what the implications are. So the woman who's to marry there, you see, would be the anima that's going to get committed again, but in the old way. And if von Franz marries there, that means that the influence of von Franz on his life is going to stay stuck in the old paradigm. She will not be able to have the effect on him to bring him into a new paradigm. So it'll be very bad. When you see these in therapy, your heart just sinks. Sometimes you can talk them through. It doesn't mean that it's hopeless, but it means you're fighting an uphill battle. So he's given a task, he's given a relationship to help him fulfill the task, and then we see what we're dealing with. That's page 63 and 64. The other thing they made of we need to talk about that. Let me see. Oh, the dignitaries. See, that's wanting to be Mr. Zurich.
Those dignitaries?
Gosthof, there I find the dignitaries of the community. And I don't know if you've ever been to a small Swiss village, but that's just the way it is. there's usually one or two Gasthauses, not exactly pubs. They're really family restaurants where guys also go and hang out and drink beer. I say guys because it usually is the guys that hang out and drink beer. And there's one table where the prominent people of the community sit. And boy, you don't even think about sitting there. And you'll recognize it when you go in. It's called Stammtisch. And it's big. It'd be, maybe enough to seat 10 people. And there'll be 10 guys sitting around there smoking cigars, drinking beer. And they are, you know, in a way, it's very irritating. You should just realize that's who's in control of this town, those 10 guys. And that's what shows up here. I don't think it's quite as dramatic, and it would have been quite as dramatic in in a town like Zurich, but this is in Küsnacht, which was itself a small village. And, you know, there are these places in Küsnacht where Jung lived and the Institute is. And Pally lived just right next to Küsnacht. Where you go in and there's just 10 guys sitting around smoking cheap cigars and drinking beer. And they are, you know, they are the powers of the bee. And he could not go against them. Which means, that, very simply, had he walked into a Gasthaus as Herr Professor Pally, you know, he would have been swooned over. And had he spoken the truth, he probably would have been ignored. It was that concrete.
Before we leave that, I think we went over again, but I think, what does that mean by the blonde woman also sits at the table when she's sad, she's crying, says that she will lose her Christianship because of he is because B is married in a German.
Because it might be a title. Yeah, it's probably a title.
Yeah. And then Fräulein, the dignity of Fräulein France is also to marry it here.
Yeah, well, that's what I just said. It's because she is marrying a German. That the feminine is entering into relationship, into committed relationship, into longevity of relationship, in the old value system. The old son. The old value system.
You mean his feminine?
His feminine, right.
And so, what's that have to do with the Swiss versus the German?
Well, the way he takes it is that the Germans are very earthy. The Swiss are very earthy. You know that famous, the favorite picture of Jung, I don't know if you remember, is Jung standing in Balingen, resting on a stick, looking like an old farmer. You've heard my story about Jung, the stonemason. They are very down to earth people, almost like maddeningly so. I mean, everything works in that country. Everything works. You can literally set your watch by the train. Very practical, not given to intellectualism. I think in Swiss German there are only 800 words or something like that. It's a very primitive language, and a very gutsy language. Where at least as the Swiss see the Germans, they are much more intellectual, much more cultured, more elevated off of the earth in what can, at its extreme, become effete culture. And I think that's the sense, that she's losing touch with the earth, getting caught up with all this grand cultural stuff. Or with intellect, to be very simple. Mm-hmm. And so if von Franz so his anima is in danger of losing touch with the earth, mm-hmm. which would be his feelings, his earthy, physical feelings for her, because he always tried to shove his bodily experiences into his intellect. We'll see that a couple of times coming up. And for von Franz to marry there would mean that his connection with her is not going to get past the value system which he is meant to transform, which is basically power, prestige, control, classical patriarchal stuff, and the separation of spirit and matter. So there he is to write on spirit and matter, and he's got himself in a relationship where his matter is telling him what his spirit should do. He doesn't like that. The patriarchy does not like it when the matter tells them what to do. They want to control everything. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
An interesting and to me controversial commentary is at the bottom of page 64. Transference. I hate that word. And I've never really understood why. Let's talk a bit about it. Because his point is that Pally is forming a transference with von Franz. I did like his quote, and it does express why I resist the word transference so much, I think. There is such a thing as transference which is so obvious that you can't miss it. And that I don't have a problem with. And that's the way Freud used the word transference. Transference is when the client replays a childhood experience with the therapist. So the client sees the therapist as a parental figure. In other words, projects unfinished parental business onto the client. Simple example. I can think of just some very extreme situations where, you know, I ask people to write down their dreams. Some people go nuts over that request. They yell and scream and they call me a fascist and a bastard. See, that's transference. It's perceiving their authoritarian relationship to their parent vis-a-vis me. And some of them will blow up and walk out. I've had people leave because I insisted on written dreams. Because that means I'm a fascist. We see the fascist is in themselves, and they don't know it, so they experience it on me. That's what Freud and Jung, to some extent, mean by transference. Conversely, that's a negative transference. Conversely, there are positive transferences, where you're idealized. Oh, you're so brilliant, and everything you say is so fantastic, and you're a genius, and actually, no, I'm not. I'm just an ordinary guy trying to make a living. But the perceptions are colored by either, you know, the idealization of the parent they didn't get to have, or that they're stuck in. So that's the basic Freudian idea of transference. And yes, it does appear sometimes. But are all strong feelings from client to therapist transference? No. It becomes particularly complicated when the feelings are love, or the state of mind is love. Let's read what Sybil Burkhäuser Uri says. Now, Burkhäuser, this is Burkhäuser's wife, those of you who knew. Know Burkhäuser's art. And, you know, I would consider her one of the real ones. I don't always say that about my colleagues. Hear how she talks about transference, and then try to distinguish what I just talked about transference, how she talks about transference, what the difference is. I wouldn't use the word transference for what she's saying, but that's another issue. Let's just hear the difference. The conscious mind cannot know in advance what the unconscious intends to achieve by a transference. In other words, by what happens when the client falls in love with the therapist or just has very strong positive emotions, sometimes mixed with erotic desire. Conscious mind cannot know in advance what the unconscious intends to achieve by a transference, and should rather for that reason wait until its purpose is revealed by the unconscious itself. It has been demonstrated that one cannot come into contact with the transcendental background of one's own psyche without a relationship to another person. That one can, so to speak, meet a part of one's own self in another person. In the realm of the unconscious, there is no opposition, no differences, not even between me and you. Others are part of us in this type of experience, and we of them. The things they do are our actions too, and we share in the responsibility for them. See, the way I talked about transference in what I just said is that, prior to reading this, is that it is something explained by the past. But certain feelings can only be explained by the future. And that's what the previous discussion I mentioned doesn't understand. When it's time for you to make a next step, the psyche can weave an erotic fascination onto you for the person who represents that next step. And that next step needn't be something that has ever existed before. It can be a brand new creation in your life and in your historical time and your community. And that's what these feelings are about. They are a manifestation of the purposive activity of the psyche, riveting you to somebody that you need in your life to acquaint you with where you're going. And that word transcendental background, those of you who did number and time, remember that's the word for, I've also used the word a priori identity, for who you were born to be. And the way you get to know who you were born to be is sometimes by looking who it is you are attracted to. So she certainly makes that distinction, and I like that. My resistance to coin the word transference is it's a category, it's a psychological category, and I personally resist applying a psychological category to the highest function of our personality. I would rather say, this is God at work, if you want to use that language. Love, if you have any sort of religious feeling, you know, is beyond the ego. Christianity would say God is love. So another dimension of experience breaks into you to bring you to who you are. And it has nothing to do with where you've come from. It has everything to do with where you're going. He is saying Pauli's relationship to von Franz is a transference in this latter sense of the word. And in a way, I see his point. I would just say, there's love there, and the nature of love is to bring you to who you are. I don't know why you have to psychologize it. Because the fact is, you do not interpret these things. She says right here, you wait until the thing manifests itself. Does that make sense? It's a big difference. And if you listen to the talk in my field, which everybody now is in a transference, blah, 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 transference. Listen, if it is not the reductive meaning of transference.
So what would be an example of it being manifest, for example?
In a dream?
Oh, a dream.
Yeah, that you would see in a dream, in time, the meaning of what these feelings are pointing to. And I can tell you, having been through it, the moment that is understood, the feelings dissolve. From 1 second to the next. It's amazing.
Well, it's because it becomes conscious as opposed to being unconscious.
Right.
But Edinger talks about a transference as being, can occur through induction. And it seems that the description you're using on the one hand is that if you're pathologizing behavior on the one hand, but on the other hand, there's this induction that happens when you encounter a force that overwhelms the ego, when one encounters a force that overwhelms the ego, and it's, in a sense, surrenders to it. Yeah. It's also an unconscious sort of thing, but it's not a negative transference like you're saying.
Right. I think he's talking about the latter, the second type there.
Okay.
See, the key is, and you know, I hadn't thought of this, but it's a helpful distinction. You surrender to this transference. I think that's why it irritates me so much to use the word transference, because it implies, it carries over the old notion that transference is something that you dissect. You don't dissect this; it dissects you.
How would this transfer differ from the I guess Buddhist
yogi
kind of a thing. You know, where you, the master is.
Well, it's generally, this is a sexual experience. This is a sexual feeling.
Which do you...
The way we're talking about, the second version of transference. Okay.
Would that be related to the guru kind of thing?
That's a difficult question. I've always been allergic to all that kind of stuff.
I have too, but I was... when you explained that, made me think that maybe some of that dynamic is going on there too.
I would hate to generalize, but certainly it's you might say prejudice, that that's the case. Yeah.
That it's not going on that way.
That it's really... people are simply projecting parental images onto these authority figures. Mm-hmm. And the authority figures are so naive that they accept it. See, the great danger for the therapist when you receive this is that you think you're the great guy that you're seen to be. It's easy to reject a negative transference if they're calling you an asshole. But it's harder to reject it if they're calling you, you know, tremendous. I remember a case of a young woman who went psychotic, and the dream she had before she went crazy was that she and her father were mining gold, and they found it, and he stole it and took off. She loved her father, and he identified with that love, and he took it as a statement of his own greatness, and robbed her the possibility of becoming the greatness for herself that she saw in him, and she went crazy. That's what sick people do. They identify with this stuff. That, I guess, in a way, is the value of calling it a transference. But I think when this genuine love strikes between two people, and you know, just because you're in the therapy art doesn't mean it's not genuine love. If you met somewhere else, it might have still occurred. It happens to have occurred in this in this context. Well, the psyche doesn't care where it's happening. It's so much more complicated and so much more real that these technical terms just bug me. Because I think, as Tom said, both people have to surrender to it and just let it guide them to wherever it's going until it appears in a dream what that meaning is. It's you know, this is what Jung talked about in the book Psychology of the Transference. Some of us did it many years ago over at Judas. It's you could say an alchemical interpretation of transference.
Well, let me ask you that.
Yeah.
This would be the last one. Often, with Freud and Jung, there was the male therapist and female client. Is the same thing happen if there's a male to male?
No.
What happens then?
A whole different dynamic. I think it probably could happen between two homosexual... I have worked with homosexuals, and they have never formed an erotic transference. I mean, probably because I'm too, whatever. But maybe two homosexual, a therapist and a client, good. Then I think it would be the same. But almost for the transference to work, there has to be a counter-transference. In other words, the other person has to feel that you're responding to them. And I'm just not going to probably respond to a sexual feeling from a man. So it doesn't happen. Another way to put this is that eros is symbolic. That to me is the bottom line. I think we get a little too hung up in anima and animus. But the basic point is, what bringing us in to clarify the homosexual situation, that it's when there's real eros that has a purpose. I would prefer to say he had a experience of eros with her, and he was to endure that until the purpose manifested itself. That's how I would put it. For me, that word just, it's like making a poem the words. You know, a poem is something bigger than the words. And to me, it transfers, takes that eros and turns it into a concept. And it's not a concept. That's my two cents.
My question is, when you said when it's understood, then the feelings go away. I don't understand that, because eros isn't a concept, so it's, I mean, it comes and visits us with, at its own will, and,
yep.
And we're out of the, I mean, we're out of control, so how does all of a sudden it dissolve? How did intellectually we make it dissolve?
We don't. We just understand something and then it goes away. And what remains is a friendship.
I would think, too, is that part that you were erratically attracted to is integrated somehow through feelings rather than an untrue, isolated into
exactly.
thought. It's
exactly.
integrated, so it no longer needs to go flow out. The
yeah, exactly. Yeah. The other thing, too, which I want to stress, I said it, but let me just say it again, is that this stuff occurs when it's a question of bringing something into being that's never been before. And in Pali's case, what has never been before and what still really doesn't exist is a synthesis of matter and spirit. So that being tapped, as he was, I feel, to work on the basic split of our civilization, what this Eros was doing in his life was preparing him for the work that needed to be done then and still needs to be done now and probably will be done sometime in the future. So these things always point to the future, and they're creative. Something that didn't exist before is created. I have not been through it many times. I've been through it a couple times. It doesn't happen often, thank God. Because it tears both people up, let me tell you.
Don't keep being an occupational hazard.
It's a real occupational hazard. And these poor bastards that, you know, ended up sleeping with their clients, it's always a disaster. But it is so, I mean, really, I have said to myself, oh, she's the one. I'm going to throw everything away. I don't care. Finally, she's the one. And then you're like, hey, thank God. But that you are so seized.
Yeah.
That but having, you know, thank God, I had one of these experiences in training. And the guy who walked me through it was C.A. Meyer. And it was just wonderful to hear him help me get out of my psychological head and allow this thing to work and kind of realize how you really are a vessel. And that it will resolve. And that several people I've gone through this with, we're still friends. We're in touch 20 years later. Not a lot, but, you know, they have their own lives. But a real rapport builds up. In addition to their life, and sometimes my life, taking a new twist. So that's what's going on with him and Pally. I just wanted to clarify my feeling about this word transference. Certainly, Sybil does a pretty nice job of clarifying the difference between what I would call reductive and prospective transference. And I just was saying, I wish she hadn't used the word transference, but she did. Not many people you're going to hear in my field talk like that, but that's the way I feel about it. Remember we had like one or two dreams ago, the stranger started the fire when he was up above.
Before we went to the I have to ask, you know, and I'm sorry for those who aren't doing the vision seminars, but Christiana had to actually have the erotic physical relationship. Why is it different with therapists and, you know, the client, you know, when
lawyers?
I don't think you can decide, I guess, is what I was getting at.
Well, it's one of these things that you have to ask yourself, why did I meet her here? in the therapy situation. And that is just as much a fact as my having met her. See what I mean? So I take the whole situation from the point of view of fate. That we could have met someplace else. We didn't. And I think some other powers are activated when you walk into that analytic consulting room that aren't activated elsewhere. And concretizing and those powers just do not mix. And this is how attorneys make a lot of money.
Well, context is everything.
Yeah. And I've worked with several women who have slept with their therapists. And they are ruined. Ruined. I have not been able to do anything.
Why is that?
In the unconscious, it's a sacred marriage. That therapist becomes God, and they become gods in the unconscious. And anything a mere mortal says is excluded because it's merely human. But he said this. And you can argue, you can reason, and you cannot get past the feeling that that's the special guy. Even though he may have completely screwed them over. In the unconscious, it's stuck that he's God and you're just a mere human being. I have never worked with a woman who's been incesting. Intercourse, repeated intercourse with her father. But in training, I was in a seminar with a guy who was working with a young woman who was sleeping with her father. And it was a psychiatric seminar. And that guy was doing his best to get her away from him. She was not... I don't think she was underage. So legally, there's not much she could do. And one time he said, after the 10th time of trying to get the two of them to separate, she started screaming at him. And she said, "You don't realize, once you've been to the source, everything else is secondary." That's what incest is to the unconscious. And that's what happens if the therapist sleeps with a woman. It's incest. The unconscious. Oh yeah, I was saying that the stranger lighted a fire. I forget which dream it was, but a couple back that forced him down. And I think this is the fire that was lighted, and it was to force him down into his physical self so that he could respond to Von Franz so that she could help him do this work. And I think these actions are that teleological. There is really an arrangement going on in the unconscious. So you see, behind this fire, behind the moon, is the stranger. So that this Eros experience is meant to serve another part of ourselves. Maybe that's another reason why you can't concretize it. The Eros is just the vehicle. And there's another reality at stake, and that's the stranger. And if you mess up his design, that's where you get into trouble. And I say that to explain the first sentence of the author's commentary on 65. The unconscious intention was to further the connection between modern physics and depth psychology. That was the deeper intent of the unconscious, personified by the stranger. The stranger arranged that Eros with Von Franz to get them working together on this subject. And I think the unconscious is that specific. There are definite, specific things we are to do. And it will create all sorts of little scenarios to bring us into what it takes to do that. Why? Well, one idea would be that's what individuation is. I think the other idea is this is what cultural evolution is. What we're seeing here is how the culture is trying to evolve through one person. Does that make sense if I put it like that? The culture needs this problem solved. So it picked Pali to begin working on it. And that's what the stranger is about. And then the stranger arranged that Eros thing to bring him into his task. So if you betray the Eros, you're not just betraying yourself, you're betraying the evolutionary drive. The cultural evolutionary drive. Just like there's a physical evolutionary drive, I think there's a cultural evolutionary drive. Which might be the strongest drive of them all. And our own individual drive to growth is a piece of that. But very often they're superimposed. Kind of deep stuff, but...
Can that have something... can that be something that's creative in a sense? Since that's Eros as opposed to...
It's always creative.
Erotic... relationship kind of thing. It can be something that you're called to create.
Yes, definitely. I would say almost, it's a dangerous word, but I would say almost always. And, if you wanted to think, why is sex the way this gets accomplished? Because sex is about making babies. And this is about making a cultural baby.
Creating.
I think this is Jung's great contribution. Because remember, Freud was focused so much on the transference. And I remember this, the first case I dealt with. I would discuss this in seminars, which are just awful, the Jung Institute. You don't get much of education at the Jung Institute. You get it at your private hours. And it was all about this woman's past and blah, 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 blah. And I took this into Meyer, these points of view, and he just blew up at me. He says, that's why she's coming. This is not pathological. That's when I started to realize the difference between a real Jungian and what we're getting in the marketplace. Everything has to be in a category as it's being worked out, as my field gets watered down. But seeing these original people, they just took this experience as a sacred event. And let it evolve. It takes a lot more out of the therapist to do that. It's so much nicer to check boxes about what's wrong with the person. Yeah. I think that's one reason I feel so strongly about it.
What did you think it was, Garrett? When you said you were taking this stuff to him, what did you
think? I thought she and I should have an affair.
Those relationships.
Oh, yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. I let that slip out. One time he said, Marx, you fuck her, you're out of here. That's pretty clear.
Good advice.
Good advice.
It would seem to me important as a therapist that you have that kind of container for yourself, that you've got somebody else that you can be taking those, especially when you're new. Right?
Yeah, I don't. I couldn't have done it, certainly alone, I couldn't have done it with the standard Jungian training. I had good supervisors who were working just at a different level than the way we were trained in the classroom.
Yeah.
Yeah, and none of these people would participate in the Institute. Von Franz wouldn't, Meyer wouldn't. I think this is why. It's so hard to teach this stuff. How do you teach this in a group? It's much easier to give people a list of things to do, things to say, categories to check off. But it was a totally individual experience, which no paradigm, no set protocol would have ever solved. It was my being versus her being. That's it.
So what are you saying? No one's being trained properly anymore?
I wouldn't say no one, but I think it's what I was trained to do and what is generally being taught are two different things.
So it's dying out?
I think it's dying out, yeah. Hmm. I think it is.
Isn't there a new institute under formation now at the... in Zurich?
I'm not sure they're any better. My feeling was in Toronto, there might still be something genuine going on. New York, Boston, San Francisco, I think, are... It's Freudian jargon, Freudian work with Jungian jargon. And this essential mystery is missing. L.A., you know, the Edinger's group split away. He's deceased now, but a group of him, and so there's two institutes in L.A. I would like to think that the people around him are trying to stay true to this stuff. So I wouldn't make it black and white, but certainly the emphasis is on technique and not on the reality of the interchange. They may do good therapy, but they're not doing what Jung's talking about, which is this transformation into the transcendental self, which is beyond categories. Again, the work they were sharing at this time was her work on Descartes and his work on Kepler. Are you aware of those two works?
Is that from?
Yeah. Her essay. I thought sometime I'm trying to lecture on it, but it is really, really difficult. Her paper is called The Dream of Descartes, and it's published in her book, I think it's just called Dreams, put out by what's that group in Switzerland? Small publisher? Diamond. Diamond, yeah. It's the dream Descartes had just as he was developing his Cartesian model. So it's a reaction from the unconscious to the birth of science. It's really a wonderful dream. And she spent, you know, 100 pages on it. It's very well worth reading. It is not easy reading. And Pauli, remember, did we talk about it? Went back to the time when Kepler and Flood were in, we talked about it, I think, when Kepler and Flood were in disagreement. So they were both working on the same theme. What was going on in the psyche at the time science was generated, to see how the unconscious was responding to that development so we can get a picture of what our challenge is now, maybe to go back and reintegrate the things that were in the dreams of those people then. Does that make sense? So it's very interesting work, trying to go to the unconscious to solve these problems. Pauli's essay is in published in I think two places. Is it Jung's essay on synchronicity? Does anyone know that book? I think it's in his book on, he and Jung co-published a book. I think it's Jung's synchronicity essay and Pauli's Kepler essay. And it's also in his book called Writings on Physics and Philosophy by Pauli. It's published by Springer, S-P-R-I-N-G-E-R, Springer, The Relation of Mary. Springer Verlag in Germany, but it's in English. Both of them are really heavy going, but boy, they're worth it. I mean, it's the kind of thing you read a paragraph at a time. You put it down. So that is what was going on consciously, and I think that's what the fire, the moon, was about, to bring them into contact, to share their work together. It might just be a point to mention, those of you who did number and time. We're going to see later that the theme of the Orient starts to play a very big role in these dreams. And remember number time. Von Franz goes to the Orient quite a bit for some of her commentary. And I think that's why. I think Number and Time was the book that she should have written with him. But without him, she wrote it herself and tried to do as best she could. And you'll see some of the things we'll be talking about in his dreams are what show up in Number and Time. And how great it would have been if he could have worked with her on that. Because I think scientists will say her science in there is weak, and I'm sure it is. She wasn't a scientist. But to have his rigor and her Jung would have been a fantastic volume. The other thing that's mentioned here very briefly is that, in the middle of 65, is that the stranger, remember, the stranger takes him, or he's going to meet the stranger at the old sun. The stranger is his version of the medieval Mercurius. Do we need to spend a little time on Mercurius?
Explain what that referred to.
let's see. Well, Mercurius. It's related to Beethoven's Fifth. I'll just read it. Mercurius tempts us out into the world of sense. He is the blessed greenness, the many flowers of early spring. He is at the same time a Hermes Thonios, a earthly Hermes, and an Eros. Yet it is from him that there issues the light surpassing all lights, the modern light, for the stone is none other than the figure of light veiled in matter. Well, Mercurius is the alchemical, one of the main figures in alchemy. It goes back to, his name is taken from Mercury in Rome. And Mercury in Rome was the Roman name for Hermes. Hermes was the messenger. Mercury was the messenger. And the alchemist's idea was that there lived in this matter, this god Mercurius. Remember, these are pre-scientific people. And Mercurius was the beginning of... Mercurius was... in the matter at the beginning of the work. When they cooked the material, Mercury would travel. That's how I think they picked Mercurius from Mercury and Hermes. Because Hermes, they were messengers, Hermes and Mercury. Mercury would travel from his beginning state to his end state. His beginning state was just Mercurius. His end state was the stone. So he was the beginning of the work, he was the end of the work, and he was the process between the two. So he is the process of transformation in matter. That's what the alchemists added to it. He was a messenger within matter, which means the process of knowing through matter. And he shows up in dreams when people are to learn something from their physiological experience, namely sex or aggression. They're the two places the body is activated.
Synchronicity.
Yes, I have to say that. Yeah. Although I think synchronicity usually comes around some strong desire. See, the point is, again, we've been talking all along, he's just another image for the unity of matter and spirit. That the matter is the vehicle for the spirit. With the added dimension of it being generally a biological experience, which is meant to convey information. So the biological experience for him was von Franz. The information it was meant to convey was his future working on and maybe attempting to solve the split between spirit and matter. And he usually is experienced through joy. The joy of love and sex. That's why he's called the blessed greenness in the many flowers. And Thonic, remember Thonic, it means earthy. He is that messenger which works through the earth. And he is a light. He is a way of understanding that comes through matter. And it's a modern light.
So Faust behaves in that way too, huh?
Pardon me?
Faust.
Mephistopheles.
Yeah.
Oh, in Faust.
I mean,
yeah. Sure. Although poor Faust gets done in by Mephistopheles. Because as Pali was done in, this is such a strong experience. And it goes so much against collective living. But that's only because collective living has gotten off the track from what we really need. What life really needs to survive. See the evolutionary thing again. That's how I understand it. And that showed up in the dignitaries. Dignitaries don't care that your soul is fulfilled. They want you to pay your taxes. That's all. So that their structures, which gratify their ego, can be built. But this Mercury, see, is concerned about the state of your soul. Is humanity in this civilization satisfied? And then the light veiled in matter, that's just another word for the spirit of matter. It's overpowering, and this is where you have to have a strong and ethical personality to survive. You know, if you read Jung's Confrontation with the Unconscious, that was his encounter with Mercurius. It just about tore him to pieces. But what came out of that then is Jungian psychology. And that was to be what Pali was to go through, and what was to come out of it was some more work on spirit and matter.
So do you take Mercurius as an archetype?
I think you could say that, yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, if I use psychological language, see if this makes sense. Mercurius would be a personification of the teleology of the unconscious. Does that make sense? The side of us that's moving us forward, trying to move us forward. For Jung, it's the strongest drive. And the only other kind of added ingredient here is that Mercurius works through matter. The way we get aware of that drive is through those experiences our bodies bring us into. And this is why the church then had to dismiss Mercurius. Mercurius doesn't care about the Ten Commandments. He cares whether life survives or not. And if rules have to be broken to do so, he's okay with it. And you can see when people get in these experiences, there is always an ethical complication. Which, if you solve ethics on the small level, you kill the experience. Yet there's a greater ethic trying to work through it, which is a shift in consciousness that is required for humanity to continue and to grow. But there are often very complicated situations. Well, that's about an hour's worth. That takes us to 65. You're right, Mary. We didn't get through. We didn't get through page 73.
Two pages.
Two pages. But it's important, don't you feel, to get this stuff clear?
Oh, yeah.
That takes us to right before Dream 18.
Okay.